Inigo's Ninth Dream. Ediard hadn't visited the House of Blue Petals for nearly a month. Now, with the court case winding down, he stood on the street facing it, as the sea breeze gusted along Upper Tail Canal. Finally, the winter was ending, with the onset of spring conjuring some much-needed warmth across the Lyot Sea. A light drizzle swept through Ediard's concealment to dampen his face. He continued to stare at the building with its long oval windows, frowning at the vague feeling of disquiet stirring in his mind. Men went in and out the same as they always did. The doormen stood like muscular statues on either side of its three tall doors. Even the piano music drifting out across the street was pleasingly familiar. When he pushed his farsight through the sturdy walls, he detected nothing out of the ordinary. The bar was full of eager clients, with the stewards mixing their drinks, which the G-monkeys delivered. The madam made her rounds. All around the gallery, the girls pouted and batted their eyes, radiating faux longing. Up on the third floor, Ival's mind was its usual tight knot of suppressed thoughts. He was in his office as always, with several people in respectful attendance. It was all perfectly normal. So what's wrong? One day he would really have to make sense of these sensations which occasionally haunted him. But this was hardly as bad as the night Ashwell was attacked. He would just have to be alert, that was all. The two sailors walking up the steps never knew they were shadowed, putting any nerves down to the questing gaze of the uniformed doormen. They were waved through. Ediard followed them across the threshold. The decor had changed slightly. Ival had bought some large colored glass globes over 2 feet in diameter, their swirling patterns of amber and aquamarine clashing in gentle curlicues. 10 of them stood on ornate wooden pedestals around the walls of the bar. Ediard gave them a mildly disapproving glance and slipped further into the room. A dog barked loudly. Ediard froze. He hadn't realized the animal was there. Its mind was similar to the G-monkeys. It was a beagle, chained up to one of the big iron door hinges. Even as he reached for its mind to quieten it down, the doormen were slamming the doors shut. Huge metal bolts, 3 inches thick, were rammed home, locking the doors tight. He whispered, "Oh, crap," as people started shouting. Several clients were in a panic, scurrying round to find some route out. He had to flatten himself back against the walls as one militia officer ran past, demanding to know what was going on. A group of the uniformed doormen had clustered together around the bottom of the stairs. They were brandishing revolvers. "Gentlemen, your attention, please," Ival shouted.
"Quiet!"
Ediard looked up as the bar fell silent. Ival was standing on the gallery, both hands on the rail looking down, his irregular lips open in a brutish smile. Ediard almost let out a cry of dismay. Tanal was standing beside him, surveying the upturned faces with that superior leer of his. Ediard had met Ranelagh's father only once before, at a fabulous ball the Gilmorn family had thrown in their mansion. As they'd shaken hands, he'd seen where Ranelagh got her hauteur from.
"Lady, but I'm an idiot."
"I'd like to welcome my newest guest to this house," Ival announced loudly and smugly.
He held up a pair of socks Ediard recognized. They'd been left behind in that lodge on the Iguru. That was what the beagle must have scented.
"And I extend the full use of the bar to you, Water Walker."
The clients gasped in consternation, looking round to spot Ediard.
"Everyone else is now entitled to a free night with my girls. Please make your way up the stairs. Quickly, gentlemen, thank you."
As the doubtful clients did as they were told, Tanal produced a large pistol which he checked casually. Several of Ival's lieutenants had also appeared on the gallery equally well armed. There was no way Ediard could get up the stairs unnoticed. The group of doormen at the bottom were pressed close together and using their third hands to form a barrier. Every client was scrupulously checked over before they were allowed up. When Ediard used his farsight to probe down, he couldn't find any tunnel directly beneath the House of Blue Petals. It would be easy enough for him to smash through one of the doors, but to do that he'd have to drop his concealment, and that was what this was all about, he realized. Ival must be desperate to know how Ediard gathered information. Right now, He simply suspected. Edyard looked at the pistols lining up around the gallery. Again, he could protect himself, but at the cost of concealment. He couldn't decide if he'd be safer standing under the gallery or moving round when they started shooting. The last of the clients scuttled up the stairs.
I know you're here, Ivar called down.
Tanal aimed his pistol down into the bar and fired. The noise was thunderous. Edyard flinched as the bullet smacked into a high-backed chair, blowing a big chunk of wood out of the back. He'd never seen a bullet that powerful before. Ivar laughed and pointed his own pistol down. Edyard scuttled to the side of the bar and crouched down. The barrage of shots which followed sent splinters and clumps of cushioning feathers flying through the air. Some of the lieutenants had a grand time shooting abandoned glasses on the tables. Ivar held his hand up and the firing stopped.
Ready to say hello yet, my young friend?
Edyard looked across the floor. It was covered in debris now, and cushioning feathers were still fluttering through the air. He would never be able to walk across it without disturbing something. They'd see him instantly. Ivar began to reload his pistol, slotting unusually long bullets into the cylinder.
They say you come from the country, somewhere back west, he said casually. That probably means you're unfamiliar with parts of our city and how it works. Everyday stuff the rest of us take completely for granted. For instance, did you know that if there's a fire, the walls simply repair themselves? In a month, you'd never even know anything happened.
Edyard eyed the back of the bar. He might be able to make it to the rear storeroom without making too much commotion. One of the wooden pedestals began to tilt as a third hand pushed it. Then it fell over, sending the colorful globe crashing down. The glass smashed. Liquid splashed out. Edyard gave it an alarmed look. He hadn't known the globes contained anything. That was when he realized the liquid was actually Jamolar oil, used in lanterns everywhere on Quarentia except Macathran, where there was no need. The remainder of the globes were shoved over, smashing to flood oil out across the floor. He watched it spreading towards him with growing alarm. This was getting serious. He wasn't sure his shield could cope with fire and these bullets. The oil was getting very close to the nearest stove. Ivar finished loading his pistol and snapped the chamber back.
Come out, wherever you are.
Edyard looked above the ganglord. The ceiling, which vaulted across the whole bar, was inset with broad lighting rosettes, whose tips extended down to the walls in a scribble of slender volutes. Their pale orange radiance was at its strongest. He ordered them off, and to remain off. The bar was plunged into darkness, with the flickering coal flames behind the stove grills shedding tenuous fans of light. He leapt up and started sprinting for the door. A pale silver light flared above and behind him, revealing his splashing footprints.
Huh?
Edyard twisted round to see both Ivar and Tanhal encased in a glowing nimbus.
You're not so special, water walker, Ivar jeered. You can't even walk on fire.
He thrust his hand out. The glow brightened all along his arm. Then tiny sparks were cascading from his fingertips, falling down from the gallery like a phosphorescent spray. Edyard dropped his concealment. The oil ignited. Flames soared up from the slick floor. A vicious blast of air knocked Edyard into the piano. The shield he'd flung round his body just managed to survive the impact, mitigating the blow. He didn't dare breathe as the flames surged round him, reaching far above his head. Up on the gallery, the girls were screaming as the fire licked up round the wooden railings. Thick smoke churned through the air.
I see you, Ivar shouted victoriously.
He started shooting. Edyard dived for the floor, plowing up a thin wave of flaming oil which sizzled across his shield, barely an inch from his clothes and face. He was managing to ward off the worst of the heat, but his skin felt as if he was immersed in acid. His leather coat was smoldering. Still, he didn't dare draw a breath. Bullets punched into the floor beside him, scattering razor-sharp splinters. Up on the gallery, the squealing girls were fleeing down corridors. Terrified clients shoved them aside in their own haste to reach safety. Ivar and his lieutenants remained steadfast, their shields protecting them from the worst of the flames. They fired away manically with their pistols. Bullets started to strike Edyard as his attackers drilled through the fire with their farsight. They were like hammer blows on his back, sending pulses of agony along his spine to explode in his brain. He couldn't sustain his shield much longer. He desperately needed air. His thoughts pushed down hard into the floor, willing escape, pleading, "Help me!" And the floor miraculously changed. He started to fall. There was nothing below him. A bullet hit the shield at the back of his head. He screamed and blacked out. Edyard woke to a uniform pain that throbbed horribly. Even before he was fully conscious, he threw up. After that, he simply lay where he was in the hope the pain would fade. His hands and cheeks were sore where the heat from the flames had penetrated his shield. He could feel bruises all over his back. Bright light made him blink sticky tears from his eyes. Slowly he began to shuffle round and sit up, wincing at every move. It was very quiet. He managed to focus. What he saw made little sense. He was lying on the floor of a great tunnel, not as wide as those which mirrored Macathran's canals, but perfectly circular. Nor was there any water trickling along the bottom. The walls were as smooth as glass, which is what they could well have been made from. He couldn't be sure, for they glowed with a painful intensity. A proper white light, too, not Macathran's usual orange. In fact, this whiteness had a shade of purple blended in, which was why his eyes wouldn't stop watering. Up the curve of the wall was a line of scarlet points which shone with equal intensity. They stretched out on either side of him as far as he could see. And that was the problem. He couldn't see any kind of end to the tunnel, not in either direction. Edyard clambered to his feet, wincing as he gingerly probed his back with his fingertips. His coat was ruined. The leather was hard and cracked with some strips flaking off, as if a knife had been slashing at him. His boots were also in a bad way. The dross-silk resin soles had blackened and turned soft. Where he'd lain on the tunnel, it was smeared with patches of oil. He eased himself out of his coat and patted the dross-silk waistcoat underneath. The weave had several loose dints. It had probably saved his life, he admitted. When he touched the back of his head, he gasped at the pain from the lump. "Thank you," he said out loud to the city, and slowly sank back down again. He knew he was going to have to rest up for a while. His farsight couldn't reach further than a few inches through the tunnel wall. By now he'd decided he was in one of the very deep tunnels, which lay a long way underneath the usual canal tunnels he used. If so, then he was really alone in a way he'd never been before. Nobody had been down here since the city was built, and he still didn't know what kind of creatures those might have been. Whoever they were, they'd certainly built very well, though why they would want to build a lighted tunnel like this was beyond his comprehension. But then that was true of the whole city. He tried to relax, though it was difficult. Without the city's usual background babble of long talk, which he always ignored, the isolation was quite crushing. He was also angry at himself for what happened in the House of Blue Petals. Of course, Ivarl would figure things out eventually. Concealment was not a secret in this city, not among the masters, and quite a few others. And that ability Ivarl had, the glow that surrounded both him and Tanarl, the sparks, that was something Edyard had never heard of before. Now, though, he wasn't entirely surprised, not since that final night he'd spent with Ranelli. Like all the grand family daughters, Ranelli was a lovely-looking girl. She had raven hair, which she, well, her maids anyway, brushed straight every morning, so that it would fall halfway down her back. Her face was also long, with narrow eyes and a cute little nose. Again, all nice features, except in combination they gave the impression of coldness. That seemed to be another eternal feature of Macathran's aristocracy. The richer or more powerful the family, the less laughter was to be found in their lives. However, she was fiendishly enjoyable in bed. And truth be told, he was rather excited at the way she spent a couple of weeks maneuvering Christiana out of the picture. That single-minded possessiveness when focused on him alone made her even hotter. He certainly didn't object when she announced they would be spending the weekend at a family-owned lodge out on the Iguru. Maxen and Boyd enviously wished him luck. He'd often wondered afterwards if they were being prophetic. The lodge was a work of art, made from carved timbers and decorated with a tasteful excellence which only the Gilmorn money could provide. He enjoyed the very human architecture after the city's relentless, non-human appearance. They took almost no one with them, as Ranelly defined the five servants who were there to cater to her every whim. At night she dismissed the staff to their cottage.
"Outside their far-sight range," she explained with relish, "because we won't be able to keep a seclusion haze going."
He was led into the main bedroom with its huge, normal bed, one with a wooden frame and springs and a feather mattress. The first he'd slept on since Plax, he realized, with a fond recollection of Franley. Ranelly made him wait while she attired herself in some of the most expensive lingerie produced by the city's couturiers. Never before, Edyard thought, had so much money been so incredibly well spent. It must have been the wine and being graced with such a vision that left him so vigorously aroused. Ranelly exploited that state and her own sexuality quite ruthlessly. Sweet little Franley would have been appalled by their behavior.
"I like that you're so receptive," Ranelly told him as they lay side by side on the lavender-scented sheets.
Ranelly, he discovered, wasn't the kind of girl who wanted to cuddle afterwards. Candelabras in each corner of the room produced a mild yellow light, enabling him to see the expression of distant satisfaction on her face as she stared up at the bed's embroidered canopy.
"On every level," she added.
"Yes," he said, not quite sure what she was saying.
"I have a proposition for you. I'm sure Christiana and others have made it, but I have the contacts and ability to make it work better than they ever could. And in addition, you wouldn't be entirely dependent on Gilmorn money, which for someone like you would be quite important, I imagine."
What kind of proposition?" Edyard was still reliving the last couple of hours. He'd never been so ferocious before. It was an abandon she had demanded and responded to in kind. The exhilaration had been overwhelming, making him desperate for it never to end. She turned her head to give him a shrewd stare.
"I marry you and arrange for rewarding contacts with all those desperate third and fourth daughters."
"Marry?" he blurted. They'd known each other for a few weeks.
"Yes. I am a second daughter, you know."
Yes, that's very flattering, Ranelly, but I'm not quite sure, what I want."
"Well, it's about time you seriously started thinking about it. You have value now. You should capitalize on it."
Edyard wondered if he had misheard something.
"Capitalize?" "Well, face it. For all you're popular and interesting, you'll never be mayor."
"Why not?" he asked indignantly. Ranelly laughed.
"You're not one of us, are you? You don't belong to a grand family."
"The mayor is elected by the city."
"Dear lady, are you joking?"
"I can make it to chief constable. As a grand council member, I'd be eligible to put my name forward."
"With our family backing, you probably could get that far. But when did the chief constable ever make mayor?"
"I don't know," he admitted.
"Never."
"Oh.
So don't be silly. I'm talking about the future."
"All right." He was stung by the crack about him not being able to achieve much on merit. "What's the proposition?"
"I told you. I'll be your gatekeeper."
"I'm sorry. I don't get any of this." She rolled onto her side and reached down between his legs.
"Exploit your potential. That's what the families truly value. These, to be precise."
Long-nailed fingers closed around a very sensitive piece of anatomy.
"Potential? Lady, you're ignorant. I just didn't realize how much. How do you think families like mine achieved our position?"
"Some of it was luck, being in the right place at the right time in history. Some of it was down to hard work, your family especially. Your ancestors took huge risks exploring new markets with their ships."
"Crap. It's breeding."
"Right.
You doubt me?"
"The one thing the families cherish more than anything is a strong psychic ability. That's what we use to maintain our position. Farsight that can see what our rivals are up to inside a seclusion haze. A third hand strong enough to protect ourselves.
and a few other useful little talents, too. We prize that trait above all others in a mate. That's what every family bloodline nurtures. And now you've walked out of the wilds and into the city, a simple country boy with more strength than a dozen family sons put together. We want you, Water Walker. We want what these contain.
Her fingers closed tighter, nail tips sharp on his scrotum. Edyard kept very still. His tongue licked round his lips as she held him on the threshold of pain.
Okay, I get it now. Good boy. So I marry you.
She smiled and stretched provocatively. Her voice purred, echoing round inside his skull.
You get this magnificent body whenever you want, and in whatever fashion you desire. And you've already discovered how fantastic that will be for you. I'm everything a man dreams of, aren't I?
The way she spoke, it was a taunt, a challenge.
Yes.
He couldn't lie to her. That same husky voice had goaded him throughout the night. It spoke directly to some animal deep inside, awaking the most shameful desires. Yet she was the one suggesting them, rejoicing at how bad their bodies could behave. The notion of every night for the rest of his life spent like this one was igniting a fever inside him. He would fight every bandit on Quarentia to make it happen.
I will yield to you, she promised meekly. You will father a host of lovely little girls in me. They will run round the mansion and live a life of luxury and make you so unbelievably happy while you clear the scum out of the city and ascend to the chief constable's office. That's by day, she vowed tantalizingly.
And by night?
Ranelagh's smile mellowed. She eased her grip a fraction.
Her lips were now so close they brushed his ear.
I will bring a multitude of the city's minor daughters to our bed.
Now her hand crept up to hold his stone-hard member. Edyard smiled in utter bliss as she directed his imagination to the satisfaction his masculinity could achieve for him.
Each of them yearning for you to sire a daughter. They will pay to receive your fulfillment again and again.
Yes.
He groaned ecstatically.
Beautiful girls. Young girls. Girls like Christiana married off to equal non-entities out in the merchant classes or the militia. Our country cousins. They'll have the daughters who'll go on to marry the next generation of first sons. Every family will be in a fervor for them.
She sucked in her cheeks thoughtfully, suddenly playful.
Maybe I'll be able to negotiate a percentage of the dowry as part of your stud fee.
Edyard was suddenly bedeviled by an image of Mistress Florell, which he must have allowed to slip out. Ranelagh laughed delightedly.
Her? Yes, that's why she was so sought after. She is an amazingly strong psychic. I'm four generations down from her myself. And don't forget Ra, either.
Ra?
Why do you think every grand family claims to be descended from him? We actually are. A third hand strong enough to cut through the city's crystal wall. Who wouldn't want that?
I never knew any of this, he said softly.
It all made such perfect sense now she'd laid it out. Within three generations, your descendants will rule Macathran. That's less than 100 years, Water Walker. And then you will be king in all but name. Think what you can achieve with such power.
I will break them, he said, eager now she had opened his eyes to so many opportunities. I will destroy the gangs.
The city will regain all it has lost since Ra's time. The Sky Lords will come again to carry us off to Odin's Sea.
I will go there with you. Yes, together.
As it is this night, it will always be for you. I pledge myself to that cause. Your pleasure will never end.
She rose above him, face gleaming, triumphant in the tranquil candlelight.
Now you will celebrate our union, she told him,
a whisper filling the room in a crescendo. Edyard's mind lost all focus as his flesh obeyed her demands. He was lost between ecstasy and delirium.
You will give me our first daughter this night, Ranelagh decreed.
Edyard laughed ecstatically. Let's just hope it is a daughter. Tears of joy were running from his eyes.
It will be. They all will be, Every girl knows how. How? How to take care of an inconvenience like that. They must be girls. But the boys? There can be no boys. They have no value. The families practice primogeniture, apart from the odd embarrassment like the culverts, so your daughters can marry directly into a family's main lineage. What? His thoughts were swirling as panic contaminated his physical delight. What? The embryos are not people, she crooned, not at the stage where their gender becomes apparent. There isn't even any discomfort for me. Don't think of this anymore. What? No! Relax, my beautiful, strong water walker. Do what you do best. No! Edyard shouted. He felt smothered, fighting for breath against a torrent of horror. No, no, no! He pushed, pushed hard, pushed with his third hand, pushed himself away from such evil. Ranelagh wailed in shock as she flew through the air. Edyard was panting hard, trying to shake the miasma from his thoughts. He felt as if he was shaking off a nightmare. His heart was yammering in his chest. He searched round frantically to see Ranelagh sprawled across the rug at the foot of the bed. She looked dangerous, her hair wild, a snarl on her lips as she stood up and faced him. What happened? He gasped, still fearful. He could barely resist the urge to continue, to bend her over the bed and take her, and from that to rule Macathran through his offspring. I set you free, she growled. Her voice seemed to clang around the inside of his head. He groaned at the intensity, jamming his hands over his ears. I showed you your real desires. Follow them. Liberate yourself. Stop it, he begged. He was curling up, struggling against his own treachery, the yearning to follow her path into the future. Inhibitions aren't for people like us. You have strength in your blood, as do I. Think what we can achieve together. Believe in us. That last she caterwauled at him. The force behind the command almost sent Edyard tumbling from the mattress. Her mind was bright and hot. It finally made him realize it wasn't her voice he was battling. Somehow she was speaking directly into his mind. Insidiously potent long talk had corrupted his own thoughts, forcing him to bend to her will as if he were no more than a genistar being ordered to clear up manure. He clenched his teeth and concentrated, willing his third hand to contract around him, becoming hard enough to deflect long talk, pleading to the lady to make him strong enough. Listen to me, Ranelagh demanded. Edyard could see her lips still moving as her voice faded away. Every trick he'd learned in the city about shielding his emotions was woven together and reinforced by his telekinesis. He crouched on the mattress, hearing nothing, sensing nothing, isolated. Ranelagh glared at him. Once his nerves had steadied, he glared back. His hands were trembling from shock and fear. You! He gulped down a breath. You tried. You wanted me to. Oh, sweet lady! The thought of what he'd only just managed to elude sent another shiver along his spine. Ranelagh regarded him contemptuously. She said something. Edyard cautiously allowed her voice through the shield his third hand had created, but not her long talk. Lady, no! That he kept perfectly blocked. What? You stupid, pitiful, country peasant! Bitch! He spat back. Her contempt matured into utter scorn. You think that isn't you. You believe you are noble and kind. Do you know how the dominance works? It plucks at the true strings of the heart, and I am a master of those passionate tunes. I play men for the simpletons they are. I recognize what lurks within, water walker. You are all ruled by your ego and your lust, the real traits flowing in the blood. Everything I offered is a seed inside you. I simply give you the chance to let your true nature grow. I am not like that. How many family girls have you already bedded? You gave in to yourself on that quickly enough, didn't you? How many months have you and your pitiful squadmates spent in a low-life tavern, plotting and scheming to overthrow the gangs and make you chief constable? That is exactly what I offer you. Not in the way your childish daydreams imagine. I can give you all that for real. Grow up, Water Walker. Your supposed virtue cannot bring you to power by itself, for that power is ultimately what you crave. The power to shape the city in your vision. That's right, is it not?
Yes, he murmured, an honest city, one where people are not bred for advantage and profit.
Sometimes you have to do what's wrong in order to do what's right.
He stared at her, stunned.
Oh, a phrase even you've heard, then. Do you know who said it? Ra himself, as he forced his way through Macathren's walls. He knew that only inside would his people have sanctuary from the chaos spilling out from the ships which brought us here. So he gave us the city. He took the city, and by doing so gave us order and stability that has stood for 2,000 years.
No, Ediard shook his head. I'm not. Children shouldn't be born for that. They should be loved for themselves.
They would be. And ours would be destined for greatness, too.
It's not right.
Really? And what if you only marry one girl, a nice, sweet little thing who loves you dearly the way it is out in your backward villages? What do you think awaits those children of the Water Walker?
Me.
That's what. Me and all the others like me. The fewer children you have, the more valuable they become. The boys will be seduced by family daughters. The girls will be taken as trophy wives by our first sons. It will make most excellent sport. We will have the strength of your blood, one way or the other.
Not like that, you won't.
She tossed her head, regarding him with true aristocratic derision. You can achieve so much, Water Walker. If Macathran is to be remade as you would wish it, then it must change almost beyond recognition. I have no quarrel with that, for I would be atop that change. But radical change must come from within. You know how that has to happen now. Your blood must spread wide, carrying with it your will.
I can change things from where I am.
No, she said harshly. Change imposed by an outsider is an external threat, the one thing that would pull all of Macathran together. The families, the common man, even the gangs, they would unite to defeat you.
Those groups, they want me to win, to get rid of the gangs and the corruption that allows them to thrive.
They want you to get rid of the gangs, that's all. You can't do that, not without help from the established order. They're woven too tightly into our streets and canals for you to root out. The councils and the guilds won't help you unless you're committed wholeheartedly to supporting them. You don't have a choice. Your subconscious knows that. I saw your every feeble thought tonight.
So you're the easy way.
Ranelagh ran her gaze lecherously along his naked body. Lust for power wasn't the only craving you exposed. All men are the same in the end. I enjoyed that part as much as you did.
I refuse to play this game with you.
Idiot, she sighed in disgust, and held out an arm. Her third hand fished a long robe from the closet, which glided through the air to her. But then our children were never going to inherit their intelligence from you, were they?
Ediard clambered off the bed, feeling intolerably weary. He was also disgusted with himself, because he knew that part of the night had been true. Her insidious power had unleashed what lay within him.
It might already be too late for you, she taunted.
He recovered his underwear.
What do you mean? She patted her stomach. I'm at the right time in my cycle, and you certainly delivered adequately. I'll be such a good mother. I'll even keep it if it's a boy. He can start breeding in a little over a decade. A rival to you.
She smiled to deliver maximum hurt. Ediard's heart fluttered. There was a phial of Vinac juice in his luggage. He'd been so desperate to get her into the bedroom, he'd never taken it. She hadn't given him time. All deliberate, he knew now.
Fool. She's right, you really are nothing but a backward peasant.
Ranelagh caught his distress and laughed. Ediard's third hand gripped her and shoved her up into the canopy above the bed. Her eyes bulged with shock as she found she couldn't breathe. Below her, Ediard pulled on his shirt, taking his time, not looking up.
I lack your skill in killing unborns.
he said calmly. So I'd have to eliminate you to make sure he was never born into the life you envisage for him, or her. He eased off a fraction, and Ranelagh sucked down precious air.
You're too weak,
she hissed furiously. Sometimes you have to do what's wrong, in order to do what's right. He let go of her. Ranelagh crashed down onto the big bed, bouncing hard on the mattress. She scrambled round and found Ediard leaning over her. She shrank back in trepidation from the expression on his face and the timbre of his thoughts. You should never talk so casually about death and killing, he told her, not to those of us who have killed and will kill again.
You'll die alone with your dreams broken, she cried defiantly.
If you are pregnant, you will inform me, and I will bring the child up myself. He pulled his boots on and went out into the night, leaving his luggage, including socks, behind. It had been a long, miserable walk back to Macathran. With only himself for company, he was forced to face aspects of his psyche that he didn't much admire. Again and again he considered Ranelagh's proposal. He suspected she might be right about how impossible it would be to rip the gangs out of Macathran. Dear lady, was this the proposal Finnerton spoke of? It can't be. It can't. How he longed for Akeem's wisdom. Just one last question for his old master. When he pictured Akeem's kindly ancient face, his old master was shaking his head in that amused dismay of his, which had greeted so many apprentice follies, as if to say, you already know the answer. When dawn did eventually break and Ediard begged a lift off a farmer driving his cart to market, he was resolved. He would take on Ivar and the gangs on his own terms. That way he gave himself a victory over the darker nature resting in his soul. Now, looking along the brightly lit tunnel that seemed to go on forever beneath the city, Ediard knew he had another long, lonely trek home. I really am going to have to get help to deal with these bastards, he decided wearily. Neither the tunnel nor the city answered him. He shrugged and got to his feet again. It wasn't quite so painful as last time. He looked one way, then the other. There was absolutely no difference between them. Both ways saw the tunnel extend out to vanishing point, and the silence was starting to get to him. It was as profound as the time he'd used his third hand to defend himself against Ranelagh's voice. Talents, she'd said. Useful little talents. Plural. Ediard had never heard of anything like the liquid light which Ivar and Tanarl could manifest. And to think, when he'd hauled Armanel back to justice across the surface of Birmingham Pool, he'd considered himself invincible. It made him wonder how many other nasty little surprises the aristocratic families kept among themselves. He probed round with his farsight, trying to find exactly where he was. The tunnel was very deep. He examined the structure above him, searching for a clue of his fall, the direction he'd come from. Macathran had altered itself again to let him through, but he couldn't detect any difference in the solid bulk overhead. When he focused, he thought he glimpsed something. His farsight swept back, and there he was. It was like an image of himself embedded in the city's substance, falling, with his arms waving madly, his coat trailing smoke. As he studied the image, it moved slowly. If he focused on the substance above, it seemed to rise back, following his own point of concentration. When he changed direction, so did the image. Memory, he realized in delight. The city remembers me. Ediard tracked the image of himself to the place where it dropped out of the tunnel roof. It was kind of funny to see himself landing splat on the floor, but it still didn't tell him which way to walk, just where the House of Blue Petals stood above. He reached out for the city's peaceful thoughts and projected an image of Transol Street in Jeevans, where he always used a disused cellar to go down into the canal tunnels. Do you have a memory of how to get there? He queried. There were no images, which he'd only half expected anyway. Then he began to scrabble round for his footing because the tunnel was somehow tilting. The floor shifted down alarmingly fast, and Ediard slipped onto his back. He started sliding along the smooth surface, picking up speed as the angle kept increasing. It was already way past 45 degrees and building. The infinite line of red lights was flashing past. He instinctively knew what was going to happen next, even though it was utterly impossible. How can a tunnel possibly tilt? There was never any answer. The only sound in the tunnel was Ediard's scream as he began to fall down the now vertical shaft. When he stopped to draw breath, he didn't bother screaming again. After all, this was how he dropped down into the canal tunnels. It was just that he never had such an impression of speed before. Maybe if he shut his eyes. He opened them hurriedly. That was too much. He had to match up what he was seeing with what his body felt. The red lights were now a solid smear. He was going so fast. This was the freedom of the G-Eagles. A side tunnel flashed past, and he gasped in shock. Before he could wonder where it led, another had come and gone. He managed a tentative laugh. No one had ever traveled like this. It was stupendous. The night crowned him king of the city, and Honius, Take, Ranelly, Ival, and all their kind, for they were the real ignorant ones. There was only one truly frightening moment, when his body was twisted by whatever guided him and kept him clear of the tunnel walls, and he abruptly flipped out of the main tunnel into one of the junctions. He drew a sharp breath, but his worry soon faded. If the city wanted him dead, he would have joined Akim in Odin's Sea a long time ago. Eventually, his wayward flight ended as the tunnel shifted back to horizontal. Ediard wound up sliding for a long way on his arse, until the tunnel floor was completely horizontal again. He looked up and sent his farsight flowing through the bulk above. The top of the tunnel changed in that eerie and now thoroughly familiar way, and he fell up. Darkness engulfed him, and a minute later he popped up into the chill air and weak orange light of the marble canal tunnel. The sight of it was immediately disheartening. Knowing he was going back up to the city streets brought his defeat into sharp focus. He couldn't tell anyone, couldn't turn to anyone. Worse, he didn't really know what to do next. Maybe I should just leave, ride away to Ufford, and Selrana and I will live happily out in the country where we belong. It was so tempting. But if he didn't take a stand against the gangs and the likes of Ranelly and her family, nothing would ever change. And ultimately the city's decay would bring the countryside down with it. The problem would belong to his children, and by then it would be even greater. Ediard sighed and started his trek home. He spent the next day in his maisonette, long talking Dinlay at the station, claiming he had a cold. Leanne's trial was in its eighth day, but he'd already appeared in the witness stand. The prosecution didn't need him again. Dinlay wished him well. One of his G-monkeys was dispatched to the nearest doctor's house to fetch a soothing ointment, which he dabbed on his scorched skin. Then he apologized to Jessile and asked her not to come round for the evening, claiming he didn't want to pass on his cold. She commiserated and got her family's cook to send round a hamper loaded with chicken soup and other treats. What he wanted was to spend a couple of days resting up, thinking about his next move. Certainly he needed to talk to Grand Master Finnetan. Then at lunchtime on the second day, Cancine long-talked him. The Kobara district had always delighted Ediard. It didn't have streets like the rest of the city. Instead, over 100 great pillar towers rose out of the ground, all a uniform 4 stories high, wide enough for each level to provide enough room for a family to live in. But it was above the towers where the architecture excelled. Each tower was the support column for a broad bridge spanning the gap to the next tower. Most towers provided the base for at least 3 such bridges, and many had more than that, webbing the district with an array of suspended polygon structures. That was where the district's true accommodation began, extending up to 6 stories high from the low curve of each bridge platform. They formed triangles, squares, pentagons, hexagons, and right in the center of the district, the bridges made up the famous Raphael's Fountain Dodecagon, which housed the artist, botany, and cartography guilds. The fountain itself roared up from a big pool in the middle of the dodecagon, its foaming white tip rising higher than the arching crystal roofs. Ediard walked past the fierce jet of water, his third hand sweeping away the stingingly cold spray that splattered round the edges of the pool. He was well wrapped up in his fur-lined cloak, with a black ear-flap hat pulled down over his hair, and a maroon scarf covering his mouth. Nobody recognized him through his seclusion haze, though he was very conscious of the G-Eagle slipping through the dull gray sky that was keeping pace with him. After the fountain, he took a left, heading towards the Milagal Tower, with its red and blue-striped walls, covered by a leafless network of gherkvine branches. Teams of G-monkeys were out in force, clearing the last of the slush on the plaza which extended across the whole district beneath the thick shadows of the elevated buildings. Winter gave Kobara a strangely subterranean aspect, with only sallow slivers of sunlight reaching down through the elaborate structures above. In summer, the plaza was full of people and small markets, and street artists and kids playing games. Today they were all huddled next to their stoves in the rooms overhead, complaining about spring's late appearance. Ediard was glad there were few people about. His mood was still down. He arrived at the base of the Yolon Tower and went through the wide archway. A massive set of stairs spiraled up the central light well. He grunted at the sight of them, each curving ledge spaced just wrong for human legs. One day, he reflected as he made his calf-aching way upwards, he would just throw caution away and reshape every lady-damned staircase in the city. Three bridge cloisters radiated out from the top of the stairs. He took the Kimvula one, and was immediately heartened by the bustling atmosphere so high above the ground. The cloister was narrow in relation to the height of the walls on either side, five stories of ogee arches and oriel windows. Nevertheless, it was wide enough for stalls to be set up along both sides. He unwrapped his scarf as he walked past them. It was warm inside the cloister, the winter sunlight shaded with a faint pink tinge by the crystal roof. People flocked round the various stalls, haggling with the owners. The air was scented with spices and very dry. Someone somewhere was roasting honey plums. A third of the way down the cloister, he turned into a narrow side corridor which led to yet another spiral stair. Sighing, he trudged up a further three stories. The hallway on this floor was illuminated by the city's orange light radiating from the circles positioned above each doorway. He found the red door, with its ivy hinges painted purple, and knocked politely, even though he could sense the minds behind the wall. Daibal opened it. The old musician wasn't his usual self. He still wore a vibrantly colored shirt and his hair was immaculately braided, but the forceful good humor was subdued.
"Thank you for coming," he said.
His eyes narrowed as he took in Ediard's blotchy pink face.
"Are you all right? You look like you've been burnt."
"I'm okay. I had an accident, that's all."
"Strange. That'll be the second accident I've heard of this week. There was a fire in the House of Blue Petals 2 nights ago. You shouldn't hang around that place, Ediard. It's been the ruin of many a poor boy."
"I'll remember, thanks." Ediard was led into the parlor, which had a bulbous bay window looking out across the pentagonal space outside. Far below them, big nut pear trees grew in a series of troughs which curved out of the plaza floor. Their denuded branches shone bright white amid the shadows of the bridge buildings. The rest of his squad were already there, Boyd and Dinley standing close to a coal-burning iron stove, looking concerned and radiating worry. Cancine was busying herself with a samovar of tea, her thoughts tightly shielded as always. Maxine knelt on the floor next to a chair where Bijuli was sitting, his arm on his mother's legs. She'd obviously been crying. Now she was dabbing at her face with a handkerchief, wearing a brave smile. Ediard looked at the bruise that was darkening round her eye and winced. His dismay suddenly turned to anger. "Did you know them?" he blurted. She directed a fond smile at Ediard. Even with the bruise, she was still beautiful.
"No, I told them not to call you. I don't want you worried by this."
"Mother," Maxine said, "it's our fault this happened."
"No,"
she insisted.
"What did they do?" Ediard asked, almost afraid to know. He could see Maxine's hands clenching into fists.
"Nothing,"
Bijuli said. She smiled up at Cancine, who brought her a cup of steaming tea over.
"Thank you. They were just some thugs."
"Four," Maxine growled. "Four thugs." He gave Ediard a significant look.
"They told me that actions have consequences,"
the Julie said, and that Maxon should watch out. One hand caressed her son's head. They said you should find a different job. Then, she indicated her eye. I never saw it coming. Me? I used to think I was city smart. Lady, how stupid of me. Bastards, Maxon exclaimed. Cowards, Dinley said. We've always known that, Cancine said. Do you remember what they looked like? Ediard asked. Can you gift us? I'm afraid I can't, Bajuli said. It's all a bit of a blur. Maybe tomorrow when I've calmed down. Of course. I'm so sorry this happened. I don't know what Ivar thinks he can achieve. The trial is only going to last another couple of days. Leon and the others are going to get decades in Trampello. What does he think he's going to get me to do by this?
It's not your fault.
Maxon's jaw muscles clamped down. He continued to gaze up at his mother, full of concern and adoration. Did anyone see anything? Ediard asked Dybal.
No. It was the middle of the morning in the Bellis Market. Hundreds of people were there, and nobody can remember anything. They do what they always do and rush to help afterwards.
I'm sorry, Ediard said again. He felt so useless. I'll do everything I can to make sure this doesn't happen again. Dybal gave him a sad smile.
I know you will. You're a good lad, Ediard. I appreciate that. I appreciate what you're trying to achieve, too. People need hope, especially now. Shame there's only one of you. This is a big city.
The squad got ready to leave. Ediard found Maxine's blatant hostility quite disconcerting. His friend was normally the most level-headed of them all. Can I talk to you for a moment? Ediard asked Dybal. The musician ushered him into a small room which held over a dozen guitars as well as a drum set. A desk overflowed with sheet music. Normally, Ediard would have been fascinated by the instruments. Today he took a shaky breath.
I know this isn't a terribly appropriate time.
Dybald took off his blue glasses and polished them with his sleeve.
I'll help you any way I can, lad. You know that. You're important, not just because you're Maxon's friend.
Thank you.
You'll find there's very little shocks me, if that's any help.
Okay. I just wondered if you knew anything about long talk dominance.
Dybal raised an eyebrow.
The old lust slave serenade. You don't want to be messing with that kind of mischief, Ediard, no matter how pretty she is. Trust me, there can be repercussions. Anyway, from what I've heard, every mother and daughter in the city is forming a disorderly queue to drag you off to bed.
I don't want to use it. I want to stop it being used against me.
Ah, I see. Some of those family daughters not taking no for an answer, eh?
I wish it was that pleasant.
Dybal studied his face closely.
I'm sorry to hear that. First off, keep your mind tightly shielded, which is a shame. You always seem a little more open than those of us born in the city. It helps make you so endearing.
Right.
This technique works through your own weakness. Parts of us should always stay buried, Ediard. Common decency is normally enough to keep those kind of thoughts suppressed, but once they've been kindled, it's hard to put them aside again.
I know, he said miserably.
Dybal's hand gripped his shoulder.
Don't worry. Listen, there is no shame in possessing these thoughts. We all have them. If some little vixen managed to sneak through your defences and fired them up one night, then that's a lesson learned, and a valuable one at that. The fact that it disturbed you this much is a pretty clear sign that it's not part of your natural personality, which is encouraging to me, if not you. And I have faith enough in you to think you're strong enough to survive a crisis of conscience. But just in case, here's a recognition gift. It should help warn you if anyone tries that little trick again.
Ediard examined the burst of thoughts Dybal shot at him, memorizing the technique.
Thank you.
Now get yourself back onto those streets, and generally kick the shit out of Ivar and his cronies.